some very special programming today featuring billionaire Mark Cuban on how he made his money and then lost it and then made even more.
You know, Cuban made some of his money betting against some of the companies that he did business with. And of course, we'll also hear from him about owning a basketball team and how he didn't care if he overpaid for it.
And David Rubenstein, host of the David Rubenstein Show, Peer-to-Peer Conversations, begins here by kind of going through all of Cuban's successes. Let's listen in.
Mark, let me ask you this. You have, at an early age, made some money. And then you made enormous amount of money when you sold broadcast.com to Yahoo, made over $1 billion. And then you bought a basketball team. Then you have a Shark Tank series that's very successful, won Emmy Award. You're well regarded by entrepreneurs all over the world. Presidents of the United States call you for advice. What is wrong with this life? I mean, there's something about your life that isn't perfect.
I have kids. I have a 16-year-old daughter and a 14-year-old daughter. That's all any parent needs to hear. It doesn't matter what you have or what you don't have. The minute my oldest daughter turned 15, my wife and I got really stupid, lost half our brain capacity, and are beholden to our kids for their whims. It's, you know, being a parent is a challenge, and it's very humbling, as everybody knows.
Well, I have three children as well, and I agree. So you grew up in Pittsburgh, but not in a wealthy family. Is that right?
No, my dad did upholstery on cars. My mom did odd jobs.
You went to University of Pittsburgh?
I was always into business, just how I've been since as long as I can remember. And my high school wouldn't let me take business classes. And so as a sophomore junior, there were only senior level economics classes. And so just despite them, I started taking classes at night in my junior year and then dropped out of high school for my senior year and went to the University of Pittsburgh and took classes there.
But then you went to Indiana University. Why did you go to Indiana?
Because Pitt didn't have a full undergrad business program. And I saw a list of the top 10 undergrad programs and picked out the cheapest one. And it was Indiana. And I went there sight unseen.
Now, when you were there, you started a bar and it was a very successful bar.
Well, kind of successful. So my parents didn't pay for my school. My dad sent me $20 a month, and I had to figure out how to pay for things one way or the other. Sometimes I was able to get scholarships. Other times, just saving money from jobs I had. Other times it was a hustle.
So when you graduated, you moved to Dallas. Why did you move to Dallas?
I had a bunch of buddies down there that were living that had gone to Indiana and moved to Dallas. And I was talking to one, my buddy Greg Shipper, on the phone. And he's like, Mark, the weather's great. The women are beautiful. The economy's good. I'm like, wait, back up. I'm coming.
But you ultimately started a kind of a technology consulting firm. Is that what it was?
Well, what happened was when I first got there and I was sleeping in what we called it, the Hill Hotel with my five roommates. I got a job at night working as a bartender / barback. And then during the day, I applied for jobs and finally got a job selling software at this company called Your Business Software, which I did for 9 months until I got fired. And so I started my own company, Micro Solutions, which at the time was, when we started, was just a PC consulting company.
And you ultimately sold that for a couple million dollars or so?
Well, I sold it 7 years later for $6 million, of which $1 million went to all the employees, $2 million went to a partner that I brought in, and $2 million came to me, and then some to taxes.
All right, so you got $2 million, which is a king's ransom in those days for somebody your age, right?
Yeah, I was 29. Well, actually, by the time it closed, I was 30. And so I just thought I was the luckiest guy and the richest guy in the world. This was 1989. In my mind, I was just going to take time off. My driving force was I wanted to retire by the time I was 35. Because, one thing that my dad had always really, taught me and really emphasized to me is the one asset you can never own or get back is time. And so, enjoy the time while you're young. Take advantage of it. His job was backbreaking. He lost an eye in an accident at work. He did upholstery and a staple broke and destroyed his right eye. And so he would take me to work sometimes and make me sweep the floor because he wanted me to see the type of work he did not want me to do. And so when I, my goal was to retire so I can just enjoy my life. And so we sold Micro Solutions and I literally retired, bought a lifetime pass on American Airlines, just traveled the world and partied like a rock star, for the next few years.
So after you retired at the age of 30 or so, you ultimately came up with an idea which was to listen to Indiana University basketball games on, I guess, a kind of streaming process. Is that right?
By the time I sold Micro Solutions, you know, I was really tech heavy. I mean, we were one of the largest systems integrators. I taught myself the program. We did local and wide area networks. So I got to understand networking and technology really well. I made a lot of money actually afterwards just trading technology stocks, because back then it was so much easier. You know, I'd call up Rick Sherlin, who had Goldman Sachs, or, you know, Lee Ainslie before he was even at Maverick Capital. And we would just swap ideas. And I knew more about all the details of tech and what worked and what didn't work and what companies were doing well, and ended up making tens of millions of dollars doing that. I then got together with my buddy, Todd Wagner, who I knew from Indiana. He actually came to me with the idea. He was like, this new internet thing, you understand technology. Is there any way that we can listen to Indiana basketball using the internet? And I was like, that's a cool idea. And this was early 1995. And I'm like, let's try to figure it out. And literally starting with a Packard Bell PC that I bought for like $3,000 or $4,000 at Best Buy or something, or CompUSA, in the second bedroom of my house, I just sat there and tried to figure out how we would do this. And it went from, you know, 10 people the first week to 100 to 1,000 to thousands. And we knew we had something within 30 days.
But you took the company public, is that right?
Yeah, July 18th of 1998.
And the stock zoomed. I hate to use the word zoom, but it went up a lot.
The largest one-day, largest first-day IPO bump in the history of the stock market at the time.
Right. So did you say, I'm going to build this company forever and just keep growing it? Or does somebody come along and say, I'll buy it from you?
Well, the goal was to dominate, because, you know, we called it netcasting at the time, and this was pre-YouTube, and literally we were the dominant force in streaming. You know, we had rights to all the major sports leagues. We had, you know, hundreds of radio stations. By 1999, we were doing video as well, and we bought 10% of what turned out to be Lionsgate Studios. We bought, you know, video rights to all these libraries. And so, you know, we were making acquisitions. We really were on a path to dominate. And we had, Yahoo had invested in us the previous year and came to us and said, you know, we want to buy you. We need to get into multimedia and you're the leader. Let's combine forces. And they made us an offer we couldn't refuse.
So they offered, I think, roughly you ultimately did the deal at $5.7 billion.
In stock, 5.7. Yeah.
So you didn't own all $5.7 billion yourself. I guess you had some outside investors and other people, but you had a lot of it.
I ended up with about 33% of it, and was taxable. The way it was structured, it ended up being taxable on the gains. But it turned out well. Yeah.
Here's the question I've always had. And why is it that you had the foresight, or how did you have the foresight to sell the Yahoo stock at a time when the markets were going up? People thought Yahoo would be going up forever. You sold your Yahoo stock and cashed out before Yahoo went down by 90%.
Well, I actually hedged it, right? So remember I mentioned that I had traded stocks between the time I sold my first company, did really, really, really well. And I watched complete industries just skyrocket and then collapse. You know, there were companies when Dell Computer went public, there were 10 other PC companies that crashed and burned. I'd seen it multiple times, and I made money going up and I made money shorting them on the way down. And so I was very clear to Goldman Sachs at the time that I wanted to do a hedge. And so the first thing I did, because I had a 6-month moratorium where I couldn't do anything. And so I took literally almost every penny I had, 20 some million dollars, and bought puts on an internet index. And I lost all my money on that hedge, literally just all gone, which was good because that got me to the point where Yahoo was still a high flyer. And I sold covered calls and bought puts over the next 3 years. And that hedge saved me and actually made me money.
But you lost the first 20 million?
Yep.
What did your wife say?
Oh, no, I wasn't married at the time. And it was, you know, but it was timed out right. So I got through the 6 months, even though I lost the money on that hedge. I already knew approximately, you know, based off of where the Yahoo stock was, how I'd be able to, and what the volatility levels were, how I was going to be able to sell calls on my Yahoo stock and use that money to buy puts on the Yahoo stock. And when the stock collapsed, my puts were worth a fortune.
You bought the Dallas basketball team, the Mavericks, for roughly $280 million, which at the time was thought to be a lot of money. Today, it's a fraction of what it's worth. What propelled you to buy a basketball team?
So I've always been a basketball junkie as long as I can remember. And so I was a Dallas Mavericks season ticket holder. And during that time that I owned season tickets, they were awful. I mean, all of the 90s, they were voted the worst professional sports franchise of the 90s. And I'll never forget, it was the 99-2000 season opener. And we're undefeated, right? I mean, I'm a season ticket holder. I'm excited to go to the game. It wasn't a sellout. There was no energy in the crowd. And, you know, I just sold broadcast.com. And I thought, I can do better than this. And then it dawned on me, wait, I can put my money where my mouth is finally. And, you know, not just say it, but inquire about buying it. And from late October, when the concept first came up, it took till January 4th to close the deal. And honestly, I didn't even care about price. They told me, here's the price. I said, yes, because realized that I still had my hedge on for Yahoo. And I still benefited when Yahoo stock went up. So there were days still then when, this is before the internet bubble collapsed, I remember being on the team bus in January talking to the coaches, and I'm like, why did you spend so much money? This is the worst franchise in all the NBA. The revenues are lower than everybody else. I'm like, let me just show you the price of Yahoo. It went up $100 or $200 today, and that paid for the whole team.
So when you buy a basketball team, you get to play with the players. Can you work out with them, or they don't really let you to do that?
Up until obviously the changes with this season, before every home game, I go on the court and get shots up. There's nothing, you know, crazier and to me as a basketball junkie exciting than to have, you know, an arena and you're out there shooting. And, you know, there were a lot of times over the years where I'd play one-on-one with the players, or I'd shoot for money with the players and shoot threes. And
well, they don't ease up when you're playing with them. They don't ease up a little bit to let you win because you're the owner.
No, hell no. These are, you know, because realize the other side of it. If I beat them, they'll never hear the end of it. And they, you know, there's just no way.
Now, in your early years as an owner, you're owning a team now for 20 years. In your early years of the owner, and maybe even recently, you've been fined a lot by the league, maybe more than any other owner, for criticizing the referees, criticizing the league. What was all that about? Did you do that on purpose because you wanted attention, or did you just couldn't constrain yourself?
No, it was because I wanted to improve the league. I mean, when I first got to the NBA, they didn't know what their product was. They always thought that we sold basketball. And I was very clear to them that we don't sell basketball. We sell experiences. You know, if you think about the sporting events that you've gone to, you know, you don't remember the score, the touchdowns, the dunks, the jumpers. You remember who you were with. You know, the first time a parent took you, the first time you went with, you know, your friends, or, you know, the time, you had your buddy's bachelor party, or the first date there. The NBA didn't realize that's what we sold. And so, you know, it took a lot of, you know, aggression, I guess, from both sides. You know, a lot of going back and forth with then Commissioner David Stern. You know, but to his credit, while he had to fine me, privately he would agree with me on a lot of those things. You know, and so to me, I was just being a good partner, even though a lot of my partners didn't really appreciate it.
Well, in the early days, you were a very young owner. Now you've been an owner for 20 years. You may be one of the more experienced owners. Do you get people now listening to you more than they did 20 years ago?
Yeah, they're used to me. Like you said, I'm one of the longer term owners. And so, you know, I'll still raise hell and speak up, but now they're kind of used to me and they've changed a lot. A lot of things have changed, you know, whether how we approach officiating to how we market our games to what we do for broadcasts. There's just so much that has changed over the 20 years for the better.
Now, the NBA is playing in a bubble in Orlando. How is that working out? And are you surprised that it's worked out reasonably well, or you think it can be done better? Or what's your view of it?
I mean, it's shocking how well it's gone. I mean, there's so much risk, you know, just bringing such a large group of people, thousands of people together in one area and to have zero cases, that's stunning. I mean, literally, we were concerned about what might happen, you know, because primarily you're talking about a population of 20-somethings. And as you can see outside the bubble, just, you know, people 20-somethings in any city, they're not the most conscientious when it comes to wearing masks and following social distancing and other protocols. And so, you know, to our players and staff and Disney and the NBA, to their credit, everybody has been really, really careful, and it's paid off.
Dirk Nowitzki was one of your star players for a long time, a European. You have a couple other Europeans now who are stars as well. One of them, what you traded, you got from the New York Knicks, I think, and a trade that President Trump commended you on, as I recall.
Yep.
So let me ask you this, though. When are you going to recruit more Jewish basketball players in the NBA?
I don't care if they're from Mars, right? You know, if they wear a kippah during the game, I'm fine with that, too. I don't care, you know, just whatever, ever works. I just want to win.
You know, you have a very much of an everyman image where you're like an average Joe, you're a basketball fan and so forth. But the truth is, you have a lot of technology background, a lot of sophisticated financial background. So you haven't kind of portrayed that the way, you know, Bill Gates is seen as a technology guy and maybe Jeff Bezos is. But you have a lot of technology knowledge, which you don't kind of advertise as much. But clearly, you know the technology work pretty well.
I put in the time, right, when I worked at Your Business Software before I got fired. It became very clear to me that when it came to technology, there were two types of people. There were the people who created the technology, and then there was everybody else. And I was tied with everybody else in terms of knowledge of any new technology that came out. And if I put in the time and, you know, put in the effort to learn about that technology, no matter what it was, I was going to move ahead of the 99%, maybe never catch the person or the people who created the tech, but I'd be ahead of everybody else. And that's always been my mantra. And I try to stick to that today.
So as you are talking to us today, you have many different businesses, but you have a big investment business. And you've said publicly that you're a gigantic investor in Amazon and Netflix and other companies. And do you just have advisors that help advise you on these, or you just make your own decisions?
Pretty much make my own decisions. Yeah, I mean, I used to trade, as I mentioned, I used to trade a lot. I used to be very, very active as a trader. And, you know, back in the 90s and early 2000s, there was a lot less money chasing more stocks. And now there's a lot more money chasing fewer stocks. So it's harder to trade and be successful. So I just stick to the companies I believe in. You know, I've owned Netflix since it was 50, and Amazon, I was buying between 500 and 700, and actually bought some more in the high thousands, just under 2000. But I've got some scattered things, you know, beyond that I've owned over the years that I've held on to. But I no longer trade. You know, that Fed put is strong. That Fed inflation of financial assets kind of gives us a tailwind.
Now, COVID, you have said, has changed the world in terms of opportunities. It's obviously hurt people, but it's obviously helped people who are entrepreneurial. So you've said this is a good time to actually figure out new businesses, new areas of business. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, you know, it's so unfortunate, but it's true. I mean, you know, we've heard Warren Buffett say, you know, buy when there's blood in the streets. And it's almost analogous here. So many small businesses are closing. So many, you know, retail stores are closing. Malls are you know, going bankrupt. Companies that are unable to transition to selling digitally or really taking full advantage of e-commerce are struggling. Big companies aren't sure about how to protect their legacy businesses. That type of uncertainty creates a lot of opportunity. And combine that with people becoming far more comfortable with purchasing online and living a digital lifestyle, I think there's a lot of unique opportunities that are available to people who are creative, who have a vision for the future. I think, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, we'll look back and there'll be 10, 20, 30 world-class companies that were created by people who we probably are thinking are crazy right about now.
So you had a relationship with President Trump at one point, I think when he was first thinking of running.
This was after he announced, and thinking he had no chance to win whatsoever, I made a public statement saying, I think Donald Trump's the best thing to ever happen to politics. He's not a traditional politician, and he says what's on his mind. And that got picked up everywhere, and I became his new best friend. And so he would call me all the time, and just, you know, that's who he is. Until I said one day that I didn't think he was qualified, and then it was all downhill from there.
So he never invited you to the White House?
No, actually, he did recently. But, you know, everything Donald Trump touches, you know, turns into a mess. So I didn't accept the offer.
Now, you've said you might consider running for president. In fact, you had a pollster look at it. Why did you decide not to run for president this time?
Primarily because my family said no. I mean, you can't, you know, given the nastiness of politics right now and just the hate and the social media destructiveness, you know, your family has got to really be up for it. And so that was the primary reason. And the secondary reason was in the polling that I did do, I couldn't get more than 25% of the votes. I could dominate with independents, but I couldn't, you know, pull enough Republicans or Democrats from Biden or Trump.
Would you consider running in the future for president?
I hope not. You know, the only reason I considered it now is just because things are so partisan and people are putting party over country. And I thought as an independent and somebody who, you know, was not dogmatic about anything for that matter, except trying to serve the American people, that the timing might have been good. But it's not my ultimate dream job.
So if somebody's watching this and says, all right, I want to be like Mark Cuban, I want to be a leader in many different areas, be successful, what would you say are the one or two or three traits that are necessary to be a successful leader?
Find something that you love to do and be great at it. You know, most people, the one thing in life you can control is your effort. And most people don't put in the effort. They think it comes to them. And it doesn't, as you know. You know, there's lots of competition on no matter what you choose. And you have just got to put in the effort.
So behind you, it looks like is one of a replica of a basketball championship trophy.
That's not a replica. That's the real deal.
All right, that's the real deal. All right, so you look like you need another one to match it up. Are you hopeful of getting another one someday?
Oh, absolutely. You know, hopefully this year. But yeah, that's the goal with the Mavs. You know, there's one winner and 29 people tied for last place in the NBA, and this one is almost 10 years old. So Larry O'Brien back there needs some friends.
And that was billionaire Mark Cuban with David Rubenstein, host of The David Rubenstein Show, Peer-to-Peer Conversations. And that's it for Bloomberg Best.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm Denise Pellegrini.
And this is Bloomberg.